You're listening to the station that serves your community, 1240 WGBB. And now it's time for Dave's Gone By with David Lefkowitz.
Tropical hot dog night.
Good evening, mates and Sheilas. Welcome to Dave's Gone By. 90 minutes of talk radio, comedy, music, and more coming to you live from spiffy Merrick, Long Island. Happy Australia Day. We've got a ripping show for you this week. Everything from going down under to throwing up chunder. From weirdos in the news to spastic kangaroos. From Julius Caesars to cheese sneezers. It's all here tonight on Dave's Gone By. I'm Dave. Dave Lefkowitz, radio personality, playwright, theater critic, journalist, and recent 39-year-old. And my show is a mix of smart talk, serious talk, unusual stuff, and musical fluff. And yes, for the 3.5 people listening tonight instead of watching the Super Bowl, I will do my best to give the occasional score update. It's Oakland versus Tampa Bay, which brings us to our first bad pun. When is a Tampa Bay football player like an expensive corn cob? When he's a Buccaneer. Okay, I just lost 2.5 of my 3.5 listeners, and any carryover audience from Teen America is now cranking the dial to the Salsa stations. But means it's just us tonight, and if you were listening to Teen America before, by the way, that was a repeat show. My birthday show was last week. As I said, this week is Australia Day, and it's just us tonight, just you and me, mate. And count yourself lucky, because while the rest of the world is watching the National Steroid Olympics, I'll be entertaining the hell out of you here, including shaking my formidable tatas during the halftime show. Which brings me to the one caveat for the program, my usual warning. We're not out to offend anybody or upset community standards. However, Dave's Gone By does indulge in humor and subject matter for adults. So if you have children who are listening to this instead of watching the Super Bowl, they're gay. Just accept it. Your kids are flaming. Get them some Patti LaBelle albums, maybe some hormone therapy. I mean, I'm straight as an arrow, but if your 5-year-old is laughing at my jokes, he's a poof. Guarantee he keeps a stash of Judy Garland memorabilia hidden under his baseball cards. Or, at the very least, Ethel Merman's disco album. More on that next week. And speaking of the theater, coming up later in the program, I'm very excited and proud to have director Karen Coonrod talk to us. Her production of Julius Caesar, for which we have a couple of tickets to give away later on, her Julius Caesar is now playing at Off-Broadway's Lucille Lortel Theater. The play has gotten a lot of critical attention, much of it extremely positive, and Karen's work has almost always gotten a strong reaction one way or another. I first interviewed her nearly 7 years ago when she was directing all three parts of Henry VI at the Public Theater. How Henry VI managed to rule England while cut up into three parts, I'll never know. But seriously, Karen Coonrod is a tremendously bright person. She teaches Shakespeare at Yale. She lectures and directs all over the country and in Europe. She's one of those people who really goes deep into a play, explores it, and then can talk about it in a fascinating way, expounding upon it without getting boring or esoteric. Here's what she said in a 1999 interview, not with me, but with a student at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She was asked how she approached directing absurdist plays by people like Beckett, Ionesco, Genet, and Coonrod replied, quote, "I love entering into chaos and coming out the other side. I'm fascinated by theatrical borders and frames. I think they bring the audience into the moment, drawing us forward in our seats and making the theatrical experience more immediate. I think theater should wake people up. I want audience members to sit in the balconies and get involved during parts of the play. I think there's a deep need in our culture to be irreverent. There's just so much political correctness. I've never been able to stomach it. It's theater that wants to be liked, and it shows that we're afraid to offend anybody." Unquote. Well, I'm not afraid to offend anybody, except the FCC, and if you hang with me the next 85 minutes, I think you'll find that out, and I hope you won't mind. I'll step up to the plate and swing away in just a minute, but before we head down under, here's a little old-fashioned American capitalism just for you. And it's time for Dave Goes Off. No, not off the air, but off on a tangent, on a rant. And today we go the sports radio route, in honor, I guess, of the Super Bowl, only it's baseball, Pete Rose. Reports say that the Cincinnati Reds great is finally ready to admit that he bet on baseball. Commissioner Pete Selig has been thinking about reinstating him to the game. He's too old to play, of course, but he can manage a team. And most of all, he's a virtual shoe-in for the Baseball Hall of Fame. I mean, this is the guy who broke Ty Cobb's record for number of hits in a career, 4,256 of them. A guy who batted at or near 300 for almost two decades. Also, a guy who, for 13 years, denied any involvement in gambling involving baseball. This, despite the league finding betting slips and phone logs between his office and bookies. If reinstated, Rose promises to clean up his act and, you know, never do it again. There's even rumor of him going back to managing the Cincinnati Reds. Unlikely, but the question remains. Should Pete Rose be allowed back in the game, and by extension, the Hall of Fame? My personal opinion is, eventually, yes, but not yet. There are certainly reasons why Pete Rose belongs not only in the same room, but on the same wall as Johnny Bench, Willie Mays, Nolan Ryan, maybe not the Bambino or Jolton Joe, but nearly everyone else. He's one of the great players, and his very nickname, Charlie Hustle, has a triple irony about it. Yankee pitcher Whitey Ford was the first to call Pete Rose Charlie Hustle, and Ford was mocking him after he saw the young rookie get a walk, but still run to first base when it wasn't necessary. But Rose didn't take it as an insult, and he let the name work for him. He became Charlie Hustle, the guy who always hoofed it to first base, whether it was on a pop-up or a long fly ball, because one out of every 50 times you do that, the ball that looked like an easy out becomes an infield blooper or lost in the outfield sun. And if the batter has made the effort to run hard, which it seems nobody does anymore, well, the batter ends up safe at second base instead of tagged out or strolling to first. That's a great lesson to teach people about sports and life. And you could point to Pete Rose as a role model not just for ability, but more importantly for attitude. Of course, now the hustle in Charlie Hustle has a more snarky twist. But if you deny Pete Rose entry into the Hall of Fame based on skeletons in his closet, how do you justify other people already in, from the generally detested Ty Cobb to the overindulgent Babe Ruth? The great Mickey Mantle pissed away his health with a tremendous drinking problem. And look at some potential candidates, those champion 1986 New York Mets, the way overrated Daryl Strawberry, and the truly outstanding Dwight Gooden are both iffy because of drugs. But Keith Hernandez will probably make it in a couple of years. He kept pretty clean as a Met, though he was a real problem personality with the Cardinals, nearly wrecking his career, thanks to a serious dalliance with nose candy. Still, he and Gooden probably deserve to reach Cooperstown on the basis of their consistently fine play over several years. As for Pete Rose, I think he still has more dues to pay for gambling and lying. I'm not against wagering, per se. It's a perfectly okay pastime if you can keep it under control. It's also legal, and it's your business what you do with your money. But Rose's gambling is something else. It's kind of like drinking from the tub you just bathed in. And, of course, Rose lied about it for years. And before you point up the invariable Bill Clinton comparison, it's not the same. Bill Clinton cheated on his wife, but that was between him and his dry cleaners. If he was naughty, that was Hillary's concern, not America's. Should he have lied under oath? Certainly not. That was a concern. But senators had no business asking him those questions in the first place. Clinton's affair of the heart and of other organs were not related to affairs of state. The impeachment was nothing more than a political move by the Republicans to get this very popular president on something, anything. On the other hand, Major League Baseball has every right to ask whether a player or manager is involved in wagering on his own sport. At first glance, it's hard to see what's wrong if, say, you bet on your own team to win. No point spread, just straight up win or lose. That's what mayors do during the World Series, right? If it's the Braves against the Yankees, their mayor bets a giant case of peanuts versus our mayor's 20 pounds of pastrami, that kind of thing. But betting on your own league might affect the outcome of games and, by extension, the careers of players and managers. And even betting on other teams is dangerous. Let's say you're a National League manager, the season's over, and you have money riding on a playoff game played by two American League clubs. Not even a hint of connection, so you're clear, right? Except, it's the bottom of the ninth, and all you need is the pitcher to get one more out, and you win the bet. But the next batter hits a home run, and you're out $1,000. What's the harm to baseball? Well, now let's say 2 years later, both of those players, the pitcher and the batter, are up for free agency, and your team's owners, the GM, they want to sign them up. Are you really going to be 100% objective in rating these players? And that's why gambling has to be verboten across the board. Pete Rose showed poor judgment betting on the game, and worse judgment lying about it. And the only reason he might cop to being guilty now, I'm sure, is wanting to get into the Hall of Fame. He'll eat some humble pie, not with any real remorse, but because it's being served to him on a silver platter of admission. I mean, it will be pretty humiliating for him to go up there, do the press conference, tell the truth, but then he'll go on Barbara Walters or Larry King and bask in the overall admiration for his career, and he'll write a book and give speeches. He'll make more money off his association with Betty Ford than Whitey Ford. So ultimately, I think Pete Rose belongs in the Hall of Fame for the posterity of his greatness as a player. But he gets in much later on, when he's no longer young enough or vital enough to be involved in the sport. I'm not saying if he became manager he'd start gambling again or anything like that, but in a league overrun with drugs and steroid use and bad behavior, the message needs to be reinforced that Pete Rose messed up big time with greed, selfishness, and lies. So, wait till he's 70, 75, or God forbid, if before then he gets a terminal illness, then give him a last hurrah as an old man, and then give him his due. Because when kids trade baseball cards and parrot back player statistics in 2015, 2020, it isn't going to be about how many markers Pete Rose gave to his bookie. It'll be about how many times he made the All-Star team, 18. It'll be about how many times he stood on third base and chugged his way home. How many times, 4,256 to be exact, his bat connected with a baseball and made something happen. And is that worth honoring in a Hall of Fame one day? You bet. Well, that's my opinion anyway. I want to hear yours, so if you think a rose is a rose and smells as sweet or has too many thorns, drop me an email at davesgoneby@aol.com, no apostrophe, or write to me, P.O. Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557-0062. Now, we also want to hear from you if you're ready to win, a pair of tickets to see Julius Caesar at the Lucia Lortel Theater off-Broadway. You can pick any evening performance or matinee between February 6th and March 2nd. All you have to do is call in to the show, area code 516-955-1240, and say the secret word Coonrod. That's the director's name, C-O-O-N-R-O-D, Coonrod. If you are the first caller saying the secret word, you win the tickets. And they'll be reserved in your name at the box office window. You just have to show some ID and be there at least 15 minutes before curtain. So call the station now at 516-955-1240. You're not going on the air. The engineer will take your name, email address, and phone number and give you all the info off the air. You must be 18 years of age or older, no direct family members of me or anyone at GBB, and you can't have won anything from this radio station in the past 6 months. So call 955-1240, say the secret word Coonrod, and you'll win two tickets to see Julius Caesar playing at the Lortel Theater on Christopher Street in Greenwich Village. Now, if you're not sure you want to see it yet, well, right after the commercial, we'll be talking to the director, Karen Coonrod, and I think once you hear her talk about her work, you'll want to see the show. So call in, stay tuned, back in a minute. Dave here. I want to give a plug to Don Lewis, host of Entertainment Long Island, Saturday nights at 5:30. It's an hour of interviews and advice about how to get started as a performer, be it for business or a hobby. Every show has trivia, nostalgia, live music by Eddie Hug and the Moonshiners, and Don's a real pro. He puts on a good show. So give a listen to Entertainment Long Island, 5:30 p.m. Saturdays on WGBB, because the stage is a world of entertainment. Welcome back to Dave's Gone By and Dave's Got Guests. Well, a guest anyway, and I'm very proud and happy to have with me director Karen Coonrod, whom I haven't seen or spoken to since 1996, when I interviewed her back when she was directing Henry VI, Part 1, 2, and 3 at the Public Theater. Well, now she's back directing off-Broadway, as she has been in all the years since, currently doing Julius Caesar at the Lucille Lortel Theater. It's a theater for a new audience production ending March 2nd, so you have a few weeks to go see it, which, of course, we recommend that you do. First of all, thank you very much, Karen, for coming back to talk to me.
Thank you.
And, of course, the question, I heard you ask this on another radio program on WBAI, and I'm sure it's the first question you get asked, why Caesar, why now?
Well, it's a good time for it, isn't it? It's a political play. It raises questions about justice and power, and so it's a good time to be thinking about all this. I was offered the job in May and took it on, and then went to Rome for a day. You know, I was actually working in Orvieto, so it was convenient to go to Rome and walk around and breathe the air. But it feels that now is a time when we've got this dialogue between Republic and Empire, and when we've got we're in a moment of change, actually. We're in a very strange moment that I've never experienced in my life, actually, in our country. And I think that in Rome, where this play is set at the end of the Republic and the beginning of the Empire, but before really the Empire begins. I mean, Caesar's proclivities are that way, and Brutus and Cassius are going back to the values of the Republic, but what happens is that, you know, the borders have expanded, that things are in a moment of great change, and so it's a... There are some similarities. There are some interesting similarities.
Well, actually, now that puts two separate things into my head. The first one I do have to ask is, although you probably would have been, well, you were young, you did see the late 1960s. You don't think that was comparable of the Republic versus of an even greater revolution, perhaps, than we're having now?
I think that this is more dangerous. I think that this is larger. I think that was a very dangerous time in our own country, and in fact had resonance around the world too, because there were a lot of rebellions around. I remember being in France when hearing about things happening, you know, with my family. I was there and hearing about things happening in the United States and the riots and the student riots and so forth. But and then there were riots of
Paris,
the same kind in Paris.
Right.
Yeah, we were in Grenoble actually at that moment in the summer, but I remember hearing about that, but now, I mean, there was a great student upheaval, and there was a great, experience of sort of shaking up the status quo. And now, it seems to be just more apocalyptic. You know, there's something, I mean, what with everything that has happened very recently, you know, in our own city,
sure.
Which... You know, and well, some, you know, a lot of us are living on the edge already. So
spoken like a New Yorker since 1985. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, but the thing is, you know, that happened, and it was just an astonishing event to witness and be a part of, and to see and to experience on every level, internationally, nationally, and potentially personally. You know, all of that happening all at once is astonishing, but. And there's, ever since, you know, there's been much more conversation worldwide, and now we're talking about war. It's really increased the amount of political conversation that's going on in our own, within our borders, about what's happening outside of our borders, it seems to me.
Which would be a good thing, unless it all goes
thing.
To hell.
That's a very good thing. So that awareness is a very good thing. You know, and who knows what's to say. I mean, I don't think that any government really is ideal, actually, although I think that there are many good points there is hope here. There is hope, and we hang on to that. We try to go back to that dream, and I think that's what Brutus and Cassius were trying to do, too.
So in putting this Julius Caesar together, though, and with all this swirling around, were you consciously working with any specifics related to the people in government now, the people in power now, or is that just more a generic sort of empire struggle that filtered down?
Well, I'm always interested in looking straight at the text and letting the text inform us so that the characterizations are built right on the words of the text. I'm interested also in the topicality. Certain, you know, people, for instance, Caesar, our Caesar, we looked at some images of Lyndon Johnson. We also were talking a little bit about Huey P. Long. We were talking about different characters. With Brutus, we were talking about some people that we know. You know, the possibility, even resonances of Jimmy Carter, perhaps. You know, I mean, just different
characters. So it isn't just the current administration either. It's going through the last...
No, I don't think that... I think that there are different figures in our own recent history that have resonance. However, I'm never really interested in creating a topical production because I think that's very limiting and somewhat reductive. I mean, it doesn't really interest me actually at all. But it does interest me to get clues or to get ideas from those characters if it's useful, you know, whatever we know from them. I mean, what we do learn from, I think Shakespeare more than anybody writes the truth. I mean, I think that's what makes the text so, a text that we want to go back to, that keeps opening up the possibility for breathing new life into it. And I think that because of that, the complexity of the humanity is really quite thrilling for an actor to approach. I feel that the humanity in these of these characterizations are very, very complex, in fact. For instance, Cassius is a particular way, explains to the audience at the end of the first scene that he's quite thrilled and happy, in fact, to have, and surprised on some level, to have persuaded Brutus. But he's excited about it and goes on. At the end of the play, he realizes that, you know, the certain things that he felt, he's now moving past. And he says, now I change my mind. He's talking about Epicurus, you know, and having believed, having taken that way of life on, or having believed that way, and now he says, I change my mind. And that's extraordinary, really, for a character in a play to talk about changing his mind. You know, and it's very fresh, it's very exciting, it's very, very, very real.
And one thing, though, what I'd like to do, if you wouldn't mind, is give the audience or the listeners a sense of your production. Because it's a little possibly vague in the minds of people listening what you specifically do in this mounting of Shakespeare, which is not in Elizabethan costuming. It's just a sense of
right, sure, sure, absolutely. First of all, it's a company of 16, 14 men and 2 women, and they're wearing modern dress, but it's modern dress that we've refashioned in our own way so that we've been able to invent the landscape, invent the entire aesthetic of the production. It's set in a concrete... I mean, I love... One response was that we've managed to make a small space monumental, and I love that. I love that response of one of the audience members. It's slabs of concrete that you can see, it's like foundation, actually. You can see the veins, so to speak, the little pieces of metal rod that are inside this concrete. And it's very monochromatic in the beginning. Well, actually throughout, but there's a shift of color after a slight shift of color. And we concentrate on the story, on what's happening between characters, on the active thoughts, on the desires, on the rhetoric, on the images, on what's happening in the story, in these characters banging against each other, actually. So they are in suits of power, you know. It's an image of power. From the very beginning, there's an image of all the men walking forward, and they're actually, the whole company is singing, and it's a song. It's a song taken from the phrases that Cicero wrote about in praise of Caesar. It's in Latin, and there's just certain phrases that the composer took out of this particular speech that Cicero wrote in behalf of Marcus Marcellus when Caesar had pardoned him. So I'm always influenced very much by Rome itself, by, you know, in doing these history plays. Like, as you said, I did Henry VI and also King John more recently, and then now Julius Caesar. I'm interested in the time period from which it comes, and then also the time in which it was written, that is Shakespeare, and then the time that we are in now, so that there's a resonance that goes through all three. And I think that can inform our own production and can become very rich, actually.
Well, one of the things that has been said about your work, including things like King John that you've done and Everything That Rises Must Converge, a Flannery O'Connor piece that you did, I think, just a year or two ago, but all through your career is this, and it isn't a battle, it's actually a mix between an academic viewpoint and having a visceral, very visual, very dynamic kind of staging. And you were just telling me before that you also go work through the text. But is there that point, do you ever find a conflict within yourself are you trying to get the playwright's voice out there, or is the director who is really the artist using the playwright as the brush? Is that a conflict for you?
Well, I'm always trying to go to the heart of the text that interests me. Whenever it's a you know, Shakespeare text, Flannery O'Connor, I'm always trying to go right to the heart. So I would say that, and I usually try to find in that the surprises that, you know, and it sometimes are in conflict with production history. You know, I find, for instance, that Cassius can be seen as a sort of villain or something, you know, from the get-go. And I think that there's a humanity in his excitement of winning, you know, there's in his excitement. And so going a little deeper than what is perhaps perceived or often perceived, you know, I don't know. That's what I try to do. So I've always thought of it as a dance between the playwright or the text that I'm working with and me, you know. But I'm always trying to go for the heart and just be true to that, so that sometimes it could be very surprisingly spare, you know, in terms of the moment. It could, instead of having lots of stuff thrown at it. So I guess that's
Now, you started with the off-Broadway company Arden Party, mm-hmm. which you did about 20 shows with them, and or were you the artistic director?
Yes, founder. Yeah. Yeah, that was in 1987 in June. We started with Taming of the Shrew.
Right, and you've been working pretty steadily either off-Broadway or regionally and now internationally as well. Broadway has not happened yet at this point. And one of the things I wanted to point up is that the last Broadway production of Shakespeare was Kelsey Grammer doing Macbeth, somewhat underrated production, I thought, back in June 2000. There hasn't even been whisper of a Shakespeare going to Broadway since, and even that was almost anomalous, and it was a flop. Is Shakespeare almost impossible on Broadway now, considering the economics?
Oh, I don't think so, but I think a lot of people would be scared of it right now. Yeah, I mean, I think it could happen. You know, the question is, could it happen in an American production?
That's right. We're bringing over all the English companies, because I guess they could work out an equity deal to do that.
That would be a great victory if we had an American production. Thrilling, actually. But, you know, that's a little, I don't know, you know, that seems to be a little fearful prospect, perhaps, to the producers. I don't know. You know.
Moving backward and more generally.
Yeah.
Have to ask, going perhaps way back, or maybe it's even recent, what was the most influential theater piece that you've seen?
Oh, golly. Wow. Well, seen Strehler's La Tempesta.
George Strehler.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Tempest, which I've only seen on tape, but that was very influential.
On your work, or just not to the world at large, but I mean to you.
Yeah, very much. Well, for the poetry of it, for the absolute belief in the poetry of the piece. And I mean, I saw that back when I was a student at Columbia, you know. And also Peter Brook has been very influential to me for his writings and also for what I've read about some of his work before, you know, I was, that had happened before I went into theater. Certainly that was always very influential to me. I see a lot of things that I like, you know, every year that, I mean, recently at BAM there was an opera. It was one of the Monteverdi operas. It was, in fact, The Return of Ulysses, which I thought was just beautiful. Beautiful, beautiful piece of work. And before that, there was a French company, and I was very influenced by that. Let's see, they did, now I'm forgetting, it was, I think it was El Cid, and I think it was Declan Donnellan who directed that, and it was a beautiful production, also at BAM. Those were productions that I connected to a lot, you know, and felt for their humanity, for their the spare sort of aesthetic and the beauty, and yet the ferocity inside and the poetry of them. Really, really thrilling pieces of work. But I'd say that Strahler and Brook were, you know, have been very influential to me. Yeah.
And what projects are you currently working on or thinking about working on? And any dream plays or operas that you might...
Well, I am working on Orfeo of Monteverdi. And for a group in Italy, it's going to be in an open, in a courtyard, and an open-air production. And I'm working on that. I did a workshop of that last summer in Orvieto. And I'm also doing some other projects with this group in Orvieto. Also going to work on a an Elizabeth, a piece about Elizabeth I. I'm working on creating something with in California. I just did, before beginning rehearsals for Julius Caesar, I did The Visit out there with 75 students. And Mary Lou Rosato, who played Claire Zakanassian.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty thrilling. We created 85 steel swivel chairs that the audience sat in and then moved the audience. You know, we actually honored the three acts of the tech with the two intermissions, you know, and we moved around the chairs and then at the end moved the audience up so that they would look down into the space. So it was very exciting. The Visit is an amazing play, you know. So anyway.
Have you, through teaching, because you teach Shakespeare at Yale and I think you're either directing or teaching in Italy as well, or...
Yeah. Yes.
Have you grown optimistic or pessimistic about the future of theater, either as a playwright's theater or a director's theater, in the years to come?
Oh, I think, boy, I think that there's always, you know, as long as there are people around and as long as we don't lose faith in each other and in the possibility of creating something. I mean, there's a lot in the theater that's very defeating and very difficult and very hard. There's no question about it, but I think it's always possible. You can, you know, things get hard and bad sometimes, but you just pick yourself up and you go forward and believe, and then people start to connect to it. I mean, it's so thrilling. It's immediate. You know, on some level, I can't lose the joy of it and the audience coming and responding to it. And I mean, that's the final part of the equation is the audience, the final element in terms of creating the theater, the audience being there and creating that dialogue. You know, it's very exciting because the theater is so immediate and is something that allows us to talk and have a response and whatever it is, you know. And what I love is when people say to me, boy, I just keep thinking about this piece. You know, so that, I mean, the theater is so ephemeral, you know, it's gone, you know, if you have a picture, then you have a picture, or if you have a tape of it, then you have that, but really, in essence, it's over, it's finished, the essence of it has disappeared, and so where it lives is in the people's minds, and that's extraordinary, it's really pretty deep, that, you know, and the more, so that the task is to try to go deep into the imaginations, you know, to, like Emily Dickinson said, talk about, in talking about poetry, that if it blasts off your head, you know, the top of your head, then you know it's poetry. And if it blasts off the top of your head and you get to go inside the imagination of the audience, whether it's an irritating response that they have, which many of them do, or, you know...
Well, how do you know about that? I mean, do you do after-talk things?
Yeah, sometimes, you know, or you just hear about people, you know, I mean, people are pretty vociferous about how they feel about it, which I think is great. You know, a lot of people are very... But a lot of people are appreciative, you know, but a lot of people are agitated or, you know, what have you. But there's... Whatever it is, there's a response later, and often... I get people, in fact, even recently, even this last week, because we just began the previews for Julius Caesar, people wrote me the next day and said, I'm still thinking about it, I'm still reflecting, I'm still, it's growing on me. You know, whether the growing means that they start to like it more and didn't like it initially, I'm not sure. But, you know, although that people are intrigued, you know, and what I've also liked about the audiences is that they are sticking around in the theater and talking about it. Now, somebody said, oh, that's because it's cold outside.
Yeah.
But, you know, no, I love all that perverse stuff. Anyway, but, I mean, it keeps us human. It keeps us humble, I reckon. But anyway, people are actually talking about it, you know, talking about, well, what they saw and what and how it differs from their idea of what it should be, or how surprised they are about some of the characterizations, or how they disagree about it, or, you know, what's the complexity of humanity, or about, you know, where we are, how apt it is now, and the questions that are being asked, and so that leads people on to other questions. And I think it's exciting, actually.
Well, thank you for spending some exciting minutes with us, and I want to wish you best of luck on all your current and future endeavors. And please, folks, playing through March 2nd at the Lucille Lortel Theater, the theater for a new audience production of Julius Caesar. It does sound fascinating. It does sound exciting and pretty visceral. There's no intermission in it.
That's
which
right.
I think is pretty amazing. Was it running about 2.5 hours?
2 hours.
2 hours clean.
2 hours, 7:30 to 9:30.
Folks, you've got to see it. So thank you, Karen Coonrod, for joining us on Dave's Gone By.
Thanks, Dave.
Good day, Bruce.
Oh, hello, Bruce.
Hi, Bruce.
Bit crook, Bruce.
Where's Bruce?
It's not air, Bruce.
Blimey, it's hot in here, Bruce.
Hot enough to boil a monkey's bum.
That's a strange expression, Bruce.
Well, Bruce, I heard the Prime Minister use it. It's hot enough to boil a monkey's bum in here, Your Majesty, he said, and she smiled quietly to herself.
She's a good sheila, Bruce, and not a tall sucker.
There! Here's the boss fella now. How are you, Bruce?
G'day, Bruce.
Bruce.
Hello, Bruce.
Bruce.
How are you, Bruce?
G'day, Bruce.
Gentlemen, I'd like to introduce a chap from Pommyland who's joining us this year here in the philosophy department of the University of Wollamaloo.
G'day.
Hello. I'm Michael Baldwin, Bruce. Michael Baldwin, Bruce. Michael Baldwin, Bruce.
Is your name not Bruce?
No, it's Michael.
That's going to cause a little confusion.
Mind if we call you Bruce to keep it clear?
Gentlemen, I think we better start the faculty meeting. Before we start, though, I'd ask the Padre for a prayer.
Oh, Lord, we beseech thee.
Amen.
Amen. Correct you.
Now, I call upon Bruce to officially welcome Mr. Baldwin to the philosophy faculty.
I'd like to welcome the Pommy bastard to God's own earth and remind him that we don't like stuck-up sticky beaks here.
Yeah. Well spoken, Bruce.
Bruce teaches classical philosophy, Bruce there teaches Hegelian philosophy, and Bruce here teaches logical positivism, and is also in charge of the sheep dip.
What's new Bruce going to teach?
New Bruce will be teaching political science, Machiavelli, Bentham, Locke, Hobbes, Sutcliffe, Linwald, Miller, Hassett, and Bernard.
Those are all cricketers.
I'll spit.
Howls of derisive laughter, Bruce.
Australia, 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 we love you. Amen.
Another
Alec Christian.
New Bruce. Are you a poofter?
Are you a poofter?
No.
Now, right, I just want to remind you of the faculty rules. Rule one.
No poofters.
Rule two. No member of the faculty is to maltreat the abbos in any way at all. If there's anybody watching. Rule three.
No poofters.
Rule four. Now, this term, I don't want to catch anybody not drinking. Rule five.
No poofters.
Rule six. There is no... Rule 6. Rule 7.
No poofters.
Right, that concludes the reading of the rules. Bruce.
This is the wattle, the emblem of our land. You can stick it in a bottle, you can hold it in your hand.
Amen.
Emmanuel.
your campus real piss and to very rarely stable. I take her was a busy beggar and could think you under the table. David, you can't consume well on Friedrich Hegel. And Wittgenstein of the beer is one who's got a slot to swaggle. There's nothing Nietzsche couldn't teach about the raising of the wrist. Socrates himself was permanently pissed. John Stuart Mill of his own free will on half a pint of shandy was particularly ill. Made her say, could sing it away, half a grain of whiskey every day. Aristotle was a banker for the bottle, half was fond of his dram. And René Descartes was a drunken fart, I drink therefore I am. Yes, Socrates himself is particularly missed. A lovely little thing about a banker when he's pissed.
The Brothers Gibb, long before they were Disco Ducks, here they were still in their Beatles Meet the Hollies phase from their first album, the song Red Chair Fade Away. And I want to bid farewell to Maurice Gibb, who faded away January 12th at the age of 53. And yes, it's tempting to make jokes because the autopsy revealed he had messy and tangled intestines, which explains how he sang so high. And he died of something called twisted bowel syndrome. So now we know why everything the group did in the last 20 years sounded like crap. But seriously, they helped define the disco era, for better or worse, and they wrote and sang some very pretty songs in their early years, for which we remember them well. And before the Bee Gees, Monty Python with the legendary Bruce's sketch. They've been ill-fated recently. Ian McNaughton, who directed nearly all the TV episodes, died a few weeks ago, as did Barry Took, a writer and comedian who helped put the Python team together and brought them to the BBC. Meanwhile, Terry Gilliam was unable to get his movie about Don Quixote past the sixth day of location shooting. There's a documentary about the whole disaster coming out in a couple of weeks. And there's also news of John Cleese bringing a lawsuit against the London Evening Standard. He's livid over an article written by Pete Clark, who, in a very nasty way, complained that Cleese hadn't been at all funny since he moved to California. I read the article, and it was uncomfortable seeing that kind of broadside in a daily newspaper. But what Clark wrote is certainly nothing worse than things they say about comedians at Friars Club roasts. And Cleese's ubiquitous film appearances haven't exactly earned the guffaws of Fawlty Towers or A Fish Called Wanda. So I can't imagine Cleese winning the suit, especially since if he still had a sense of humor, wouldn't he just take the sarcasm and laugh it off? But enough about that. First of all, as I promised, I want to give you the score of the Super Bowl, which is 20-0 Tampa at the half. It's been Tampa all the way. It was 3-3 at the end of the first period, and Tampa scored 17 unanswered points in the second. So it's 20-0 Tampa, and we're getting away from football and back to Australia Day, celebrating in words and music. We've heard some music. Up next, a lot of... I almost forgot. I also want to mention we got a phone call, and I love how WGBB really does serve the community. There's a lost 2-year-old female Australian cattle dog. It's so fitting with the Australian nature of the show. It's grey, shy, and most likely in hiding. Either that or it likes to lick people in hiding. I can't really read engineer's writing here, but the dog, a female, answers to the name Tilly. Tilly. So if you find Tilly or what you think is Tilly, call the owner directly. Area code 516-599-6260. I'll give that number again. 516-599-6260 if you see a 2-year-old female Aussie catalog. And speaking of the Aussies, celebrating Sunday today, Australia Day, keeping words and music. We've heard some music, and now up next, a lot of words, courtesy of the World Weird Web. If you're a big fan of Dave's Gone By, and I know I am, why not join the Bystanders, the official Dave's Gone By fan club? Because you can receive a bi-monthly newsletter, get a weekly special email, an autographed membership card, eligible for discounts on show merchandise and local businesses, receive a one-hour best-of audio tape, including favorite moments from the show, and maybe even stuff we couldn't put on the radio. All this for just $10. For the newsletter, the discounts, the email, and the collector's item audio tape, it's a great deal. And if you join before March 31st, we'll throw in a signed picture of the host. Just make a $10 check or money order payable to Togol Theater and send it to Togol Theater, Box 62, that's 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557-0062. You can also join via PayPal to the email address davesgoneby@aol.com. That's davesgoneby@aol.com. Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. It's 8:26 and time for a segment I haven't done for a while and I've missed it. It's called The World Weird Web. And it's where we gather up odd and fun and amazing websites on the internet, as opposed to, I don't know, websites on the refrigerator, and we share these websites with you. Tonight, a Logos lover's dream as we enjoy two sites devoted to language. The first, www.worldwidewords.org, is not Australian, it's British, and it's devoted, quote, to investigating international English from a British viewpoint. In other words, they define and give the origins of all kinds of slang and common words and phrases, everything from crestomathy to barbecue, from flabbergasted to blatherskite, on www.worldwidewords.org. And one word I especially wanted to look up for tonight, chunder. An Australian reader wrote into the website to say that chunder is a common Australian euphemism for vomit. The derivation is supposedly from the phrase watch under, which was shouted by passengers on the upper deck of immigrant ships trying to alert those below that seasickness was on its way. Chunder! So that's possibly true, or the meaning could have come from Chunder Lu, the name of a character in a series of Australian turn-of-the-century shoe polish advertisements. Either way, the word chunder as a euphemism for puke was popularized by novelist Neville Shute and then by Barry Humphries as the rude character Barry McKenzie. Humphries is, of course, best known for another character, Dame Edna, who would never, under any circumstances, say chunder. Nor would she be likely to say any of the other many, many synonyms for throwing up. But you can see 1,277 of them on a different website. This one's called Michael's Chunder Thunder Page, and it's located at www.geocities.com/mbort. That's geocities.com/m, B as in blech, O, R, D as in disgorge, T, mbort. And then click anywhere you see the word chunder. And that brings up an endless list of synonyms as strange as they are wonderful. Everything from slubber to curl and hurl to hork. And my particular favorite is Crapo the Baza Glutz. Isn't that wonderful? Crapo the Baza Glutz, which just comes completely out of left field. So I whittled that field down to the best 300 or so, and with the help of my lovely wife, Joyce, we'll now share the liquid rainbow with you. If you're eating, you might want to wait till this segment's over for your next bite. A little pyloric music, if you please, Engineer Paul. Abdominal Voorhees, aerial bile maneuver, after dinner mints, Alan's psychedelic breakfast, analysis past paralysis, anti-poop, appetize the audience, Australian diarrhea, backwards bungee, bail the rail, mung overboard, ballistic lunch, bark at the grass, become the fountain of flavor, be the mother bird, belch chasers, Belvis, bend and send, do the big spit, bile brunch, barf, blarf, blow beets, blow chow, blow chunks, blow cookies, blow foam, blow it out the wrong tree,
blow kisses to the China goddess. Bow down before the porcelain god. Bow to the yuke of hurl. Bow to the east and worship Allah. Bowel backup. Breakfast gravity reduction. Break bulk. Bring fluorescent Chinese cheer. Bring forth the sacrificial meal. The Brooklyn mating call. Bulimic dinner. Bucket deposit. The bulimic urge to blow oatmeal. Burp with a follow through. Bush bomber mission over Tokyo. Call Berfalamu. Call Chuck on the big white phone. Call the seals. Caress the Kohler. Cast your head upon your bread upon the waters. Catch it on the rebound. Charlie chuckles. Chew backwards. Cavitate. Chuck your Cheerios. Chuck your chum.
Chunder spew. Chum for toilet trout. Chuckle Chunks, Chunky Dinner for the Homeless, Chunky Rainbow Syndrome, Turn the Portfolio, Clam Chowder Surprise, Clear Your Throat the Easy Way, Come Up the In-Hole, Commune with a Commode, Consequence of the Barfomagic Roller Coaster, Conduct a Surprise Toilet Inspection, Commit Esophagus Abuse.
Clearance, Cough Cubes, Cook for the Cafeteria, Cough Up Your Colon.
Crapo, the Baza Glux.
Paint a Pollock, Cry Mary in the Pillow Slips, Dance with Your Tub, Curl and Hurl, Death Moan, Dash the Pebbles, Debut at the Vomitorium, Decorate the Pavement, Diarrhea the Friendly Way.
De-stomachization, Disbowel, Do some Ab Crunches the Hard Way.
Do the Chunky Monkey, Drain Aim, Download, Drop a Few Friends Off at the Pool, Drown the Ants, Eat Backward, Dutch Groceries.
Emesis, Exorcise the Stomach Devils, Expuition, Fecal Burp, Face in the Basin.
Finger Food for the Less Fortunate, Fire the Franks, Fertilize the Carpet, Flash the Tonsils at the Water Mirror, Flash or Hash, Do the Five Finger Spray. Flowage, Frapper La Telephone, Frat Boy Goulash, Food Escape,
Gargle Gravy, Gagging a Bag, Galp, Give a Royal Dalton Hug, Give Birth to Flying Cream Corn, Give Your Intestines the Day Off, Give the Ants some Manna from Heaven, Give the Janitor something to sprinkle sawdust on, Glargy, Go Green,
Gush Squid, Gut Gruel Revisited, Hack and Bile, Harf, Ham Hawking, Have a Long Conversation with Armitage Shanks, Heist the Grub, Hiccup from Hell, High Velocity Reversible Peristaltic Chain Reaction, Herf, Hork, Hork the Pork, Huey.
I gotta chew my fries more, impersonate the fly, impromptu protein party, insult your shoes, Jack Chow of York, the Jersey Yodel, Jump Shot, Involuntary Exportation of Chunky Byproducts, Keck,
Kiss the Can, Lap Lung Butter, Lateral Cookie Toss, Lego Your Ego, Launch the Shuttle, Leave a Pavement Pizza, Lick the Lumps, Lipschitz, Liquid Scream, Liquidate Your Assets, Lob Liquid Hand Grenades, Lumpy Laugh, Lose Your Haggis, Haggis, Hoogis.
We'll get back to the amazing world of Chunder Spew just a little later, but now, we didn't forget, we were just saving it, the news gone by. Time for a look at events of the past week from a down underhanded perspective. In fact, we'll start with Australia. That is where a study of 311 pairs of same-sex twins has shown that smoking marijuana may indeed lead to harder drugs later on. There's long been a medical and social debate about whether pot is just a recreational weekend drug or if it can be a gateway to further drug abuse. According to the study, early marijuana smokers were twice more likely to try heroin and five times more likely to try LSD and other hallucinogens. Critics of the study quickly called all the findings into question. They noted that with twins, genetics could play an undefined role in behavior. Also, no doubt some of the people who tried pot would have tried cocaine or barbiturates anyway. And the study doesn't show how much of the stimulus to try other drugs comes from a chemical craving and how much comes from environment, namely idiot friends and people at parties offering it to you. I really wonder if you went to the North Pole and brought Nanook a couple of reefers, would you find him a week later wandering around an ice floe, washing sled windows and trading blubber for crack? I should say I take a pretty anti-drug stance, both on this program and in my personal life. I'm kind of undecided on the whole legalization thing, but I ask my listeners, especially you kooky Teen America kids, the gay ones who are still listening, I ask you not to take drugs, or if you are dumb enough to take drugs, take a whole lot of them so you can die young and give your horribly disappointed parents a break. Never understood why the station doesn't use me for more PSAs. Oh well. Anyway, speaking of substance abuse, Billy Joel must have forgotten to say his traveling prayer last night. He was driving in Sag Harbor, lost control of his Mercedes, and swerved off the road into a tree, tearing its bark off and leaving a trail of skid marks. It was not immediately clear whether alcohol was involved, though this past summer the singer did spend time, voluntarily, at a Connecticut substance abuse and psychiatric center. Joel was released from Stony Brook University Hospital this morning. His injuries were not disclosed, but at the hospital he did receive two kinds of plasma, a bottle of red and a bottle of white. In local politics, State Assemblyman Stephen Labriola from Massapequa is trying to pass a bill that would keep violent and unalterable sex offenders behind bars even after they've done their time, saying it's crucial to protect women and children from people who can't be rehabilitated. Labriola wants to pass a civil confinement law. That's where sex offenders voted most likely to shtup again, would finish their jail terms, and then go straight to mental institutions and stay there until they're either cured or dead. No surprise that the American Civil Liberties Union is protesting the idea, which they say acts as double jeopardy. They say if you want to put a guy behind bars for life, then he should have been sentenced that way. No fair giving him 20 years and then tacking on more years than a judge and a jury saw fit to give him in the first place. Advocates say the measure would only be for prisoners with a serious mental defect, people who should be institutionalized for society's and their own safety. The scary part is that there are about 15,000 registered sex offenders in New York State, which led rapper R. Kelly to say, "Really? Where can I register?" Also in Massapequa, a 14-year-old boy was arrested by Nassau County Police on Tuesday and charged with arson. The boy was upset over low grades he received on recent school exams, so he allegedly set fire to them and tossed the papers out the window of his second-floor room. That started a fire outside the house, but the weather being what it is, a burning ember blew back into the room and started another fire that gutted the whole second floor. After the firefighters and News 12 camera crews left the scene, there was apparently a touching moment between the boy and his family. The father put his arm around him and said, "Son, you shouldn't have worried about showing your mom and me those exams. Grades on standardized tests aren't a true measure of intelligence." Setting fire to your own house, on the other hand, and I know you had your heart set on college, but now I see big things for you in the fast food industry. What do you say, son? And speaking of fast food, a federal judge dismissed a lawsuit brought against the McDonald's Corporation by two teenagers. The teens, one weighing 270 pounds and the other also obese, blamed their hugeness on McDonald's meals. They said the company didn't provide sufficient information about the health risks of eating its grilled and fried foods. The 80-year-old judge said, "No one's forcing you to eat at McDonald's, and any risks you're taking are pretty much common knowledge." And I agree. I mean, how much thiamine do you really expect to find in something called a McNugget? And does a Butterfinger McFlurry have 100% recommended daily allowance of anything besides driveway sealant? I don't think so. Finally in the news, the countdown to war with Iraq goes on, with the Washington Post reporting that late last year, American forces almost had Osama bin Laden cornered. Sophisticated spy equipment was monitoring bin Laden's cell phone. They were able to track him all the way to the Tora Bora Mountains. But that's when bin Laden handed his cell phone to his bodyguard, who went off in a different direction. Still, government officials say we shouldn't give up hope. As soon as bin Laden is spotted driving his SUV in Nassau County, talking on the cell phone, they got him. Oh, wait, nobody pays attention to that law, and the cops don't stop anybody. All right, revise that joke to read, as soon as bin Laden gets in a car accident with his SUV because he was talking on the cell phone, they got him. And, surprise, surprise, Secretary of State Colin Powell says Iraq has not owned up to all its weapons and that, quote, "inspections will not work." Said Powell, "What Iraq has to do is come clean. Stop it. Stop the nonsense. Stop the cheat and retreat." And said President Bush of Saddam Hussein, quote, "he's not disarming." For his part, Hussein replied, "I am so disarming. I am also quite a looker in a pair of khakis." Well, Bush and company still have no confidence in Hans Blix and his inspection teams. They've been finding empty warheads and not much else, and they've given Baghdad a grade of B for cooperation. Satisfactory, but they could do more, especially on release forms where their penmanship is just terrible. But it's got to be a tough job, being a weapons inspector looking for that stuff. On the one hand, you've got Iraq saying you won't find anything, but if you don't find anything, you've got the rest of the world saying you're incompetent. What's kind of cool is that in honor of Australia Day, we here at Dave's Gone By have gotten a very interesting tape. In Australia, they've actually been televising the weapons inspections. It seems to be their idea of reality TV. Follow the guys into the buildings and the warehouses and see what they're doing. Well, it's as interesting a premise as The Bachelor and Hot Date. So as I said, we have a segment of the show. It's called Missile Hunter. And to be honest, I don't think the Australian inspector they've got is really on his game. listen for yourself. Here's the Missile Hunter on Dave's Gone By. When has made it his mission to protect the environment through political intervention. Steve's father was a government security advisor for the Northern Territory. He and young Steve traveled the whole Australian continent seeking out terrorist cells and weapons of mass destruction. Steve's dad is retired now, so it's up to Steve and his wife, Tari, to keep the world safe, promote vigilance, and help stop the arms race. That's why they call him Steve Merwin, the Missile Hunter. G'day, mates. I'm here in Baghdad, Iraq, on a mission to help find weapons of mass destruction and take them away from the bad guys. We're at the gates of a royal palace in southern Baghdad. We've been to 23 other palaces and haven't found anything, but I've got a good feeling about this one. The hardest part is actually getting into the palace. Iraqis tend to be very nervous around foreigners. You have to gain their trust. Now, my dad always taught me the main trick to dealing with palace guards is patience, determination, and bribery. That guard's name is Tariq Shamakala Shamakalabad. He's got 17 brothers and sisters. Before the current regime, every single one of them was likely to live until the age 50. But with Saddam Hussein in power, Tariq has already lost 3 brothers in the army, 2 more were executed on suspicion of treason, and his 2 sisters were mutilated for wearing the wrong kind of burqa. Islamic males can get pretty cranky when they're fasting, and when they're in heat, whoa, stay away. Well, we're heading out back now to the storage shed. We've been told there's the only items back there are some bicycles and 400 bags of ice melt. 3 clerks paid with their lives for that mix-up. Now we're going to walk through here very carefully. There are the bicycles, a whole group of them. Red ones, black ones, silver with a green stripe across the frame. Oh, look at that one. Oh, she's a beauty. From the shape of the seat and the markings on it, you can tell it's a male bike. I'm just going to go over and touch it for a moment. I can't make any sudden moves or these Iraqi soldiers will shoot me. Few things are more deadly than an automatic repeating rifle in the hands of a religious fanatic, so I am being extra careful. Oh, ripping! What a gorgeous bike that is! Schwinns like this used to be very common all through North America, but the mass production of gas-guzzling cars and the sheer number of people on the roads make it unsafe for these little fellas. They're now in danger of being completely obsolete. But we're not here to look at old bicycles, so let's move on and see what else is hiding in the shed. And my wife, Tari, is camped out at the hotel reading the government's official report of its own weapons collection. That's 12,000 pages of Iraq files, mate. A bong's a book in any library. Oh, now what's that over there? An old bridge table. Some empty jars of petrol. Or some fantastic old Persian rugs. Let's just check the tags on them. Yeah, just as I suspected. Made in Taiwan. Oh, over here, some old newspapers. What's that there? I think it's moving. It's a... Oh, my God! Oh, get it out! It's a snake! Snake! Whoa. Oh, my translator says it's just a common sand snake. Totally harmless, doesn't even bite. Well, still, that was close, eh? I love dogs and birds and other animals, but reptiles, I hate those things. Well, right, back to work. What else is in the shed? Old medical instruments, a lawnmower, a box of 8-track tapes. Oh, wait a second. A lawnmower? This inspection site is 20 square meters and not a patch of grass in the lot. I'm going to have a closer look. I think I'll see something sticking out of the lawnmower. Yes, definitely something there. Could be a warhead, or maybe a canister of poison gas. Now this could be extremely dangerous. So I'm just going to jump right in. And... got it! It's a bag of some kind. Alright, I'm going to carefully pull it out from under the lawnmower. You're alright, mate. You're alright. I got it. Fantastic. Let's have a look at what's inside. My gosh, it's bones. It looks like, yes, it's the skeleton of a human hand. And there's a note. August 1997. This hand was chopped off an abo for stealing a loaf of bread. Well, they're certainly tough on crime here, I'll give them that. What was that? My translator's telling me to read the back of the note. Alright. Dear Mr. Merwin, ooh, that's me. Those jewels you snuck out of the previous palace and hid in your suitcase? Did you think we wouldn't find out? Love, Saddam. Well, right, if there's nothing else here, we'll just be getting on our way. And what's that? Oh, the guard is motioning for me to put the bag back where I found it. Yes, yes, absolutely. It's important for man, when he's a guest in his environment, to always leave things the same as he found them. Sometimes upsetting the equilibrium is the worst thing you can do. All right, I'm placing the bag back under the mower, under the lawnmower, just like that. Ah! Ah! My hand! My bloody hand! Ah! Ah! That's all from the Missile Hunter this week. Join me next time when Terry, Little Cindy, and I visit North Korea and look for unexploded landmines. Ah! Ah!
That serves your community is WGBB.
I've been a trapper since I was 13. I've caught animals you've never seen, like six-legged tigers and cows without feet. But the greatest of all I was destined to meet. I was on contract for Sydney's big zoo. They asked me for wombats and wallabies too. I hid in the bush, awaiting my chance, when far in the distance I saw something dance. I raised me blowgun and stood there transfixed. He twisted so fast, nearly all my darts missed. I came up behind him and made not a sound. I jumped on the roo and brought him to the ground. Out in the outback where the possums play, I saw a creature who took me breath away. Got him sedated, brought him to the zoo. We called him Joey, the spastic kangaroo. In isolation, the roo bounced and shook. So frantic was he, it was painful to look. In less than a day, he was covered with scars from bashing his head and his bum on the bars. We gave him drugs, but they had no effect. Built him a shelter, which he quickly wrecked. We thought him the saddest we ever did see since Chow Chow the panda with epilepsy. Out in the outback where koalas climb, we got a rare one once upon a time, a danger to himself and other creatures too. We captured Joey, the spastic kangaroo. We introduced Joey into a troop, but he punched the others and sprayed them with poop. Perhaps it was puberty, repressed desire, so we tried to mate him with Agnes the Flyer. Agnes was feral and ripe for a male. She bit Joey's nuts and he started to wail. They kicked and they thrashed and they clawed and they bled. And when it was through, the two roos were both dead. Out in the outback where the quokkas hop, I saw a whirlwind I thought would never stop. Tears did flow that morning at the zoo when we buried Joey, the spastic kangaroo. Agnes was kept on display in the lab, her body preserved and laid out on a slab. 5 weeks after that, her pouch gave a rip, and out popped a baby we quickly named Skip. We crossed all our fingers and hoped for the best, 'cause Skippy looked normal at play and at rest. But soon we saw normal was not meant to be, when Skippy the Roo tried to drink his own pee. He'd stare at the sun and spend hours in a crouch. He bit his own tail and he punched his own pouch. At first it was tempting to have him destroyed, but we felt too sorry for this mongoloid. So out in the outback we set Skippy free. Soon as we did, he ran into a tree. Moral of the story is tragic, but it's true. There's nothing you can do with a spastic kangaroo.
Dave Lefkowitz here from Dave's Gone By, and I want to tell you about a product, event, or service. I'm going to talk about it for a half a minute or a minute. I'm going to make it really interesting, and all my listeners are going to go, hey, maybe I'll try this product, event, or service. It's called advertising or sponsorship, and it's easy, cost-effective, and just plain effective. To get your person, place, or thing, well, not thing, promoted on Dave's Gone By and reach listeners all over Brooklyn, Queens, Long Island, and the tri-state area, just give us a call at 516-295-1511 or email us at davesgoneby@aol.com. Check our website, hometown.aol.com/Dave's Gone By, and see sponsorship opportunities, ad rates, and more. Again, the number 516-295-1511. Insert your product, event, or service here.
A dingo ate my baby. It happened late last night. He snuck into the nursery and pulled her out of sight. He chewed her up like candy. He spit her out like phlegm. There's other corpses in the world and she looks just like them. A dingo ate my baby, the mangy little beast. My wife said call a doctor. The doc said call a priest. A dingo ate my baby, the very little singer. He ate the head for breakfast and he ate the bum for dinner. A dingo ate my baby. There's blood upon his snout. He chewed up all the organs when he spat the eyeballs out. A dingo ate my baby. He ripped it with his claws. You can see it on his fangs. You can smell it on his jaws. A dingo ate my baby. He picked the ribcage clean. He buffed up her intestines and they smell like diaperine. A dingo ate my baby. He bashed her head on stones. And all that's left is baby hair and teeny little bones. My wife is going crazy. She's always been high strung. She's out there picking baby teeth from lumps of dingo dung. A dingo ate my baby. We'll never have another. I'd gladly pay the dingo to come back and eat her mother.
Yes, the national phrase of Australia, a dingo ate my baby. A little homemade music there, as was Joey the Spastic Kangaroo. We also heard some Brubeck, some David Byrne, and Brian Eno a while back, Down Under All the Madness. If you want a playlist of music on this and previous episodes of Dave's Gone By, check our website, hometown.aol.com/Dave's Gone By. The site has photos, archival info, plus how to advertise, become a sponsor, or become a member of our growing Bystanders Club. If you want to join the club, it's only $10, and you get all the cool club stuff, a bi-monthly newsletter, a weekly email, the best of audio tape, and opportunities for other discounts and free items. Most of all, you're helping support the show. The website again, hometown.aol.com/Dave's Gone By. If you forget the URL, just Google search for Dave's Gone By and we're right up top. Time for a few thank yous. Thank you to Susan Chicoin and Joe Trentacosta for all their help. Thanks to the ever so cogent, ever so talented Karen Coonrod for being my guest. Go see Julius Caesar playing at the Lucille Lortel Theater on Christopher Street now through March 2nd. Congratulations to our lucky listener, by the way. It's a modern dress production of Caesar, 2 hours flat. None of your long, boring, declamatory Shakespeare here. This is theater as current events. For tickets, call 212-239-6200. That's 212-239-6200. So far, it's Tampa 27, Oakland 3, if you're keeping track of the Super Bowl. And I mentioned long, boring, and declamatory, but wonderful nevertheless. Did you think you heard all the euphemisms and synonyms for vomit? Oh, no way. Before I grab a Qantas plane out of here, I thought you'd like to hear some more of the marvelous chunder words listed at www.geocities.com/mbort. Hold on to your dinner. Here it comes.
Liquidate your assets. Lob liquid hand grenades. Lumpy laugh. Lose your haggis. Haggis. Hoogis. Lunch revisited. Lurch in the white church. Stomach inventory. Make love to the lab. Make frequent flyer piles. Make pavement asterisks. Make room for the seconds. Make some Ethiopian cookie dough. Make some peptic plaster. Make the chunky puddle. Make your colon feel rejected. Marinade your tongue. Monday meeting? Mix a batch of Appalachian pancake batter. Have a meal to go. Meet my friends, Ralph and Earl.
Mug the herpy. My dinner is coming to say hello. Negative chug. Non-turgible purgables. Nux vomica. Open the cud gates. Nutritional outsourcing. Oral turbo blow-by. Organ recital. Orkney. Paint the kilt. Paint the ceiling with mama's milk. Pay homage to the Irishman Huey O'Rourke. Perkin the gherkin. Pickle your gums. Play with the edible yo-yo. Pledge your allegiance to Vomitola Khomeini. Pop a gastric zit. Pop cakes, potar, power barf, prepare dinner for a racist, projectile hose bomb, protein slingshot, pucotomy, put your anus out of work, pyloric stenosis, put your best foot forward, rainbow wretch, read the toilet, reboot, rectal reject, reconstitute some soup in the toilet, regurgitate all you ate, release the lions, retro digestion, rufus, retro sketch, return the tripe, lunch flux. Ride the regurgitron. Ride the yak. Ride the wave of nausea. Ripple esophagus. Say your beads. Semi-processed meal. Send a drift. Sell a Buick. Send a gift to the down under. Serenade the drains. Gooey potpourri. Set out the roach buffet. Share your Keeblers. Shoot mouth stew. Shack foo. Shovel away. Show up late for the hunger strike. Spew.
Sing lunch. Sing the Argentine national anthem. Sing the gurgle song, slabber. Sling stomach snot. Sling for your supper, slubber snarf. Sneeze cheese, susu all over the floor. Spackle, spewage, starve your tapeworm. Spread the stomach grease. Talk to Ralph on the Komodo phone. Talk to the alligators, taste the creamy goodness. Tastes even better the second time. Thoracic bark, three-dimensional burp. Rainbow parfait. Tickle your tonsils. Toilet bowl love. Toilet snorkeling. Turn on the soup spout. Tuna salad. Swimming upstream. Try out for the gymnastics team. Yorick. Uneat. Uncle Fester. Unidentified flying chunks. Unrecoverable application error. Upward nutrition mobility.
Vector spew.
Verp.
Use the chunky mouthwash.
Visible burp.
Vomishment.
Remission.
Wamble.
Watch my girlfriend's roommate eat.
Wee wow.
Warble.
Wet giggle.
Whip the cat.
Whistle beef.
Whistle a solid tune.
Windows 2000 responding.
Woof.
Wharf.
Wrestle sea monsters.
Yabble.
Yakety yak, it's coming back.
Yank on the diaphragmatic chain.
Yatch.
Yawn for the hearing impaired.
Yell cabbage.
Yell for Europe.
Yib.
Yogle yogurt.
Yorp.
Yerk.
Zook.
Zook allures! Who knew there were so many magnificent ways to say the Technicolor yawn? And also, I want to thank my friend Kevin, who had no idea we would be doing this segment, but out of the blue, this week, sent me about 800 synonyms for the word vagina. Oh yeah, we'll be saying being that for another day. Maybe Valentine's. But anyway, it's seems we're running out the clock on Super Bowl Sunday here. As I said, scores 27-0. Special thanks to station manager Joey, no relation to the musical kangaroo. Thank you, as always, engineer Paul. Great job. Don't forget to get political with Joe Salzone live Saturday nights at 7:30. Also Saturday nights, 5:30 to 6:30. Don't miss Don Lewis hosting Entertainment Long Island about how to be a performer. Thanks to my wife, Joyce Weil, for her help. You are the reason I crapo the Bazza Glutz. Time for this jolly swagman to tuck his jumbuck in his tucker bag. Good thing I'm wearing underpants. Hope you've enjoyed the 17th edition of Dave's Gone By, Chunder Down Under. Send your comments, suggestions, and didgeridoos and don'ts to davesgoneby@aol.com. See you next week, 7:30 Sunday night. Don't miss your days going by. This is Dave Lefkowitz. Good night, good eye, and gone by.
I will go on my way and jump the hedges first.